Welcome to Raw and Paul and Charles Goyette, the weekly podcast. A regular column in the New York Times and a commentator seat on one of the big Sunday news programs will get you a lot of attention. And if you have a Nobel Prize as well, people are liable to take you seriously, even if you're Paul Krugman. The big government, spend our way to prosperity, Keynesian economist, has been flinging a lot of charges at sound money advocates. That Krugman should do so is not really news. Inflationists have targeted Austrians, who are really the only economic bulwark against them taking their fiat money schemes to their logical conclusion. And now Krugman has psychoanalyzed gold advocates, who he determines are driven not by deference to the markets and thousands of years of monetary history, but by deep, unconscious, and infantile Freudian projections. Indeed, Krugman says that if you really want to understand critics of fiat money and inflationist policies, the Austrian you need to read isn't Hayek or Mises, he says, it's Sigmund Freud. Now, some of this Krugman stuff, Dr. Paul, is just Krugman at his everyday practice of name-calling, and maybe normally it shouldn't deserve much of a response, but because of his visibility and influence, some of it does need to be answered. For example, last weekend, Krugman offered up in his column the rather dangerous idea that we don't have a debt crisis, and we never did.
And I would have to say that even if we did have a debt crisis, he might argue, don't worry about it. And essentially, that's what he's doing. You know, when his article appeared in our local Houston paper, the heading they gave it to it was, "The right is addicted to predicting inflation. Otherwise, we're obsessed with this." But I think it's interesting how often he comes back, you know, in the last year or so, attacking us. And, you know, if our views were insignificant and inconsequential, wouldn't he just ignore us? How often do we go out and talk about Karl Marx and Engels and say we have to discredit them, you know? I think he's really on the defensive, as all Keynesians should be, because the failures are out there and they're all around us. But it is just amazing to me to see what's happened to our economy and look back at policies of, you know, the spending, the borrowing, the inflating, and looking at the results. And then they doubled their efforts when the crisis hit in 2009, and nothing has gotten any better, really. There's still such high unemployment. But then he argues this case that those of us who talk this way, we're driven by conspiracy theories. I mean, how much more negative can you be? But, you know, if you think about it, getting together and talking about ideas, in the more gentle definition of conspiracy, don't people get around and conspire to promote their cause? Sometimes I feel like a conspirator. You know, I want to talk to Charles Goyette and start talking about, what do we do next? How are we going to get our message out? So that is not negative, but that he meant for it to be irrational and negative, and obviously not based on any amount of reason. But he said we who are on the right, he calls us the right, which I object to. And in writing an answer to him, I didn't talk about that. But I don't like the idea to say that we're right wingers, because libertarianism and freedom is not right wing. It incorporates the good parts of those on the left and on the right, and that's quite a bit different. But that's another way to discredit those who are presenting a message. So he can't refute the message, so he has to go after it. So right wing conspirators, those are the bad guys. But he said we're too concerned about high interest rates, and we predicted there would be high interest rates. And indeed, I have often said and will continue to say, you know, interest rates will go back up and they will be high and they will be a problem. But what he doesn't get is that's not the main problem. What Keynesians don't realize is that low interest rates are really the beginning and are every bit as detrimental as very high interest rates. It's the artificially low interest rates created by printing too much money and deceiving the market into believing there are savings out there that creates the bubbles and the malinvestment. So he concentrates on refuting us by saying, well, prices aren't going up, but they also have to fudge the figures when they do that. So the CPI doesn't go up, the PPI doesn't go up, but they don't talk about the cost of a bond or cost of food products or a cost of education or a cost of medicine. So there's a lot of price inflation going on out there. But the point I want to make is that low interest rates are the real culprit and causes the problems to develop and the need for the corrections, which he, Grootman, believes is not necessary and wrong to allow mistakes to be corrected. So you keep piling on the mistakes. And of course, that's why you have structural unemployment and a middle class that continues to shrink, which has been happening for almost 40 years. But he also says we're wrong about talking about the dollar. The dollar, he says, don't worry, don't sweat it. And if you look at some dollar indices, they're not too bad. In the last couple of years, the one index, the Federal Reserve Index, hangs around 80, 79 to 81, and it doesn't really go up sharply or down sharply. But the purchasing power of the dollar goes down. If you look at it a little longer term, the dollar has been a disaster. I mean, since the Fed has been in charge of protecting the value of the dollar, it's lost 98% of its purchasing power. So just because there isn't a total rejection in the next 24 hours, he said, therefore, our concern is our concerns aren't legitimate. But even in spite of the relative calm with the dollar right now in relationship to other currencies, which happen to be in bad shape too, in time, the dollar crisis is ongoing. And one way you can measure this is how many countries of the world are now interested about using other currencies. And there's different groups getting together. And I saw just recently that Switzerland is even talking about it. I wonder what their beef is. You know, maybe it's because we hound their banks. And everybody knows why Russia would want to get out of the dollar and China get out of the dollar and India get out of the dollar. So although the dollar hasn't literally crashed, it's very vulnerable. It's being held together with a thread, as far as I'm concerned, and that it's so fragile that we are going to see some sudden changes. But he also argues that we said that nobody would buy our bonds, and more people are buying bonds than I think makes any sense. I don't know why anybody would buy a bond, and I don't think investors. I would think, Charles, you and I probably don't have very many friends who are buying 10-year bonds to save for their children's education. It's all so much cash out there the Fed creates. They have to park it from day to day. So they do buy some treasury bills and bonds. But evidently, they weren't buying long-term bonds because that's why they had to have QE for the government to buy the bonds. And the Fed creates credit secretly, passes it out around the world. And evidently, a bunch of it ends up in the hands of the Belgian central bank and government, and they buy bonds. So this whole idea that nobody's buying bonds, I would say the average person no longer buys bonds as a wise saving vehicle. So I think that is a lot easier to understand that than him just saying, well, they're completely wrong. But, you know, structurally in this debate, one of the things that I've worked on and try to change people's minds on is just thinking about the definition of inflation, because the Keynesians want to do exactly what Krugman does. Inflation is the increase in prices, and it's measured by government statistics, even if they are rigged. PPI tells us there's no inflation. So Austrian economists make it very particular, and I was interested in the early years reading Mises. I wonder what he says about this, because I always wanted to argue it's semantics. You know, prices go up, money supply goes up, and you just have to define it. You have price inflation, and you have monetary inflation. But Mises warns, he says, you have to be careful. You don't want to let them get away with this definition, because if inflation is just rising prices, then you can blame somebody else, like price gougers, and then you can put on wage and price controls, and you never go to the Fed where the source of it comes from. So I like to emphasize that inflation is the increase of supply of money, especially in this day and age when the government does it and manipulates the interest rates in causing all the problems that we have had. But unfortunately, even the Wall Streeters are willing to accept this idea of these government statistics and all these reports, even I think when they know better, they know how the market might react instantaneously for a day or two. And so far, they've been able to churn the market and push these prices up. And everybody said, well, everything looks real good. Yeah, maybe for the upper bracket and maybe for the Wall Streeters, but talk to the middle class in spite of the rosy economy that we're supposed to have now, and talk about the people who are underemployed, and the real unemployment rate is a disaster. So that is what's going on. And someday we will be forced to address this. And those are the kind of things that will make a big difference on what we blame. In the 30s, we blamed the gold standard and free enterprise, and ushered in the age of Keynesianism. Today, we're in the midst of deciding who's going to get the blame. And if the Fed doesn't get the blame, and if we had too much freedom, we just need more Sarbanes-Oxley and Dodd-Frank regulations to smooth out the mistakes made by the Federal Reserve, then we're in big trouble. But right now, I think we're getting the message out, and I think people are starting to realize the Fed is a major component of this crisis that we have, because we know now that there's a lot of young people who are looking at the Fed and demanding that we rein in this power and at least demand an audit and find out what they're doing behind the scenes.
Well, when he tries to discredit Austrians and others for using inflation to mean the growth in the monetary base, he really pulls a trick out of the old hat, because to the classical economists, inflation always meant an increase in the money supply. If it had meant merely rising prices, they wouldn't have needed to invent the term inflation. They would have said, well, rising prices this, rising prices the other. So it is he who has taken a relatively new definition of inflation and then tried to say, well, we're using a private language that is, in his words, just pathetic.
And you know, they're getting a little bit benefits from the marketplace. They did in the 20s. There was a lot of monetary inflation, but the statistics weren't going up. So prices can be held down because of increase in productivity. Matter of fact, that in a free market, that's exactly what happens. Prices trend downward, the purchasing power goes up, and people's standard of living goes up. So there will be that. So even in this age in which we live, where we have this horrendous amount of monetary inflation, you know, we can still look around for a deal in computers and TVs and like electronics and cell phones. Prices seem to be pretty good. But there's still, the money has to go somewhere, and it causes a lot of harm. And it will go to different sections. And the more the government is involved with regulations and dictating how money be spent, say like in the housing market, there was definitely a congressional component of the bubble in the housing market, but they had the credit too, which I still think exists. So regulations, the government's involved in education, so the cost of education is very, very high. And in medicine, we have wage controls, we have price controls on medicine right now, and that's one of the reasons we have this intense demand by the Keynesians to have Obamacare, so that they can regulate prices and regulate the market. And of course, that's always been a disaster.
Well, finally, Dr. Paulin announcing that there is no debt crisis and never was, he says, he actually reveals the real folly, the ultimate absurdity of all of this fiat money nonsense. He says the debt apocalypse has been called off, and he explains it by saying that the United States, in short, borrows in its own currency and therefore can't run out of cash.
Well, you know, you see, he sort of has a distorted truth there. That's what they've been getting away with. But maybe that might be the process that's getting a lot of people nervous around the world. And while they're thinking about other alternatives, you know, precisely because of that attitude. So we borrow as much as we want, and we print as much as we want, and we give back paper that doesn't buy very much. And the one thing I keep reminding myself is that the end stages of these cycles, when you're destroying a currency, although we have had a significant devaluation of our currency over these many, many years, that the end stage is when there's sort of loss of confidence and panic, then you can rush into some very rampant inflations like we've seen in Central America, Zimbabwe, and even in this country at times, and certainly in Europe during war periods when they have to have currency reform. And I am firmly convinced that we will need a currency reform before all this is all over.
Well, when they start resorting to name calling, it's pretty clear that they do so because they can't refute your arguments. Dr. Paul, thank you for another conversation and podcast. And thank you for listening and telling your friends about our weekly podcast. I'm Charles Guay.